Hey guys, I just wanted to let you know that this podcast is presented by mybookie.ag, and that if you use the promo code MATTEK, M-A-T-T-E-K, that you will get a 50% deposit bonus on your first deposit. And given that you are a listener to this podcast, I would assume you're relatively knowledgeable about sports, and I would trust you to try your edge on the online sportsbook. You can lay down some money and get in on the action at one of the safest online sportsbooks in the world. It's the only one that I am currently using. You can wager on all sorts of different outcomes on mybookie.ag, soccer, football, any major league, esports. You can even create your own player props, which is useful for me because if you know anything about me, I do enjoy a good player prop. So if you deposit using the promo code MATTEK, M-A-T-T-E-K, you get a 50% bonus when you deposit. And I will add this for listeners of the TakeCast. If you deposit using the promo code MATTEK and you send proof of it to me on Twitter, I will follow you on Twitter and you can have access to me via DMs whenever you want. That's the TakeCast bonus that I'm adding in association with the mybookie.ag deposit bonus. Now let's get back to the show. Hello everyone, would like to welcome you to the TakeCast. My name is Davis Matic. You can find me on Twitter at Davis Matic. This episode is sponsored by our friends at DailyRoto.com. Shout out Drew Dinkemeyer, Michael Leone, and also our good friend Drewby, just smashing, you know, multiple three-figure slates over the last 5 days. The guys at Daily Roto, they know what they're doing. This episode is done with Coach Mark Collier of SpreadOffense.com, kind of continuing the conversation we had with the Murray State offensive coordinator, Mr. Nick Coleman. Think you guys will really appreciate this episode. I think it continues our trend of having meaningful discussions about what players are actually doing on the football field and how the analytics of the things that we believe really mesh in with what coaches are doing at a play level. After a quick Daily Roto spot, we will get to the interview. Daily Roto is a mostly proud sponsor of the TakeCast, a mostly sports podcast. TakeCast listeners can save 10% at Daily Roto with the promo code JANIS, J-A-N-I-S. If you are playing on DraftKings or FanDuel, Daily Roto will help you improve your daily fantasy results this fall and save time in the process with lineup optimizers, ownership projections, fantasy projections, premium content, and much more. They have all the good stuff that you want to help you make money at sports betting and daily fantasy. Their new lineup optimizer will let you build optimal GPP teams with stacks based on their projections faster than I can punt money off betting on Peter Uihlein. Sure, you can play the guys that I recommend each week, but shouldn't you also get advice from a proven daily fantasy winner like Drew Dinkemeyer? Yes, I do have better hair than Drew, but I also have his cell phone number, and that makes me a winner almost as much as it makes him a winner of the DraftKings Millionaire Maker. And it's not just fantasy. They have tools to bet on player props, golf matchups, and a customizable NFL game simulator for this fall. Save 10% with promo code JANIS today. All right, would like to welcome to the program Mark Collier from SpreadOffense.com. Mr. Collier, how are you doing?
Good, Davis. Thanks for having me on.
So before we get into the nuts and the bolts, of course, would like you to explain to the listeners, you know, what was your journey in football? What's your current role right now? How did SpreadOffense.com come apart? What is the Coach Collier story?
Sure. So played football since I was 8 years old. Grew up in Bergen County, New Jersey, which is about 20 miles west of New York City. So, a suburb of New York City, and, grew up in a family where, my older brother played football, and, it was a easy transition, for me to also, get involved in the sport. And, so from there, played, up through high school, didn't play in college, actually went to college, for baseball, but, my football career ended, my senior year in high school. And then after college, it was just one of those things where, I missed the sport. I missed being around it. It's just people who are involved with the sport understand it's, you know, it's just one of those sports that you really sometimes it chooses you.
It gets in your blood. Yeah.
Yeah, you know, some people say, you know, football chooses you. You know, you don't choose it. You know, it just kind of latches onto you. So, so after graduating college, I got involved actually at the high school that I played at, and it was actually 25 years ago. It was in 1993. So I started my coaching career at the high school level 25 years ago, and I've been kind of in and out in the coaching profession since then. You know, I had some long stints, like 8 years at that first program that was at my old high school. And then, I was at a couple of the different larger schools and currently now I'm coaching. I got back into it kind of last minute, this season, coaching, at Pope John the 23rd High School, which is a large Catholic school here in North Jersey, which plays in, you know, very competitive, well-publicized league here in Northern New Jersey. So.
All right. Well, there you go. What is your current role? Are you a head coach or an offensive coordinator right now?
No, you know, it's interesting. I'm actually, since I got on the staff so late and they were just looking to fill, you know, certain spots that were open, I'm actually on the defensive side of the ball. So I'm, coaching the defensive backs. And helping out with special teams. So, that's one of the things with football. You know, when you're a coach, you know the game. You got to know it on both sides. And I coached on the defensive side of the ball during my earlier career. So, it's been nice to be on that side. And actually helps me with my thought process on the offensive side of the ball. So that's currently what I'm doing.
All right, well, that's actually perfect, because 2 weeks ago we had an offensive coordinator on the show and we did not talk very much about defense. So a little bit later, you and I are going to talk about some defensive ways to adjust against the spread. But before we get into any of that, I've talked to at least at this point, 5, 6, 7 coaches, and none of them can really agree on how to define the spread. So that's more or less the offense that is changing how college and pro football is played. How do you personally define the spread, and how do the teams that you've coached implement the principles?
Yeah, so I think the first thing you got to think of, I think the word within the term, spread offense. So if you think of a football field, it's 53 and a third yards wide. And I think what the spread offense has done is it's been able to use every one of those yards to the advantage of the offense. So it's spreading a defense horizontally. And that usually starts via formation. So I always think of the spread offense pre-snap and then post-snap. So if you think pre-snap, you know, team comes up to the line, the offense, and they line up in a formation. So are they spreading their skill players out horizontally in order to create natural space pre-snap? Or are they, and I'm sure we'll talk about it later about the NFL, one of the best guys to do this way of doing it is Sean McVay, is he comes out in condensed formations, and post-snap he stretches the defense horizontally. So, the spread offense always starts with that. It's taking advantage of the entire 53 and a third yard of the field horizontally. And then within that, obviously, you know, every offense has a goal of going vertically, right? North and south, because that's obviously where the end zones are. So taking that horizontal stretch and then, implementing or tacking on the vertical threat to the defense is what really makes the spread offense, I think, very difficult to defend.
So these principles, as you're talking about, really the formation changes are the largest thing that we are seeing at the NFL right now. For most of the NFL's history, teams have had a fullback out there or a second tight end out there, kind of even on third downs. But, you know, last season in 2017, NFL teams ran three-plus receiver sets 63% of the time, which is the highest rate, you know, that there has ever been. So what is the fundamental difference in having a third wide receiver out there in terms of play calling? Not only just blocking, but what does this do for an offensive coordinator or for a head coach in terms of the kind of plays that you are dialing up and the way that you have to diagram those plays?
Sure. Sure. So I think if you look at just the physical nature of a fullback, an H-back, a tight end, I'll get into more of how the tight end H-back position has evolved kind of to be very advantageous for spread offense teams. But if you look at the traditional fullback, you know, he's not necessarily built physically to, you know, create a mismatch in space for the defense. His sole responsibility, a lot of times when you look back at some of the old offenses when you were in a, you know, a traditional I formation or a split back formation, was to really be in a, you know, just an extra blocker. So he was in there to, you know, help or assist in the blocking concept, you know, in conjunction with the line. So the defense didn't necessarily have to look at him as a threat for, you know, catching the football, you know, for, you know, spreading out via formation and, you know, them having to bring down an extra defender, you know, from the secondary to cover him and things like that. So I think that's number one when you look at the, you know, traditional fullback. The second part of it, and again, I mean, if you look at the game now, some, you know, teams, you know, like for example, the New England Patriots, what they do with Gronkowski, he to me is the ultimate spread offense weapon. I mean, he's big, he's physical, but you can also split him out in space, and with his size, it's just an incredible advantage in the the matchup that you get with a secondary player, you know, a defensive back, just because of his combination of physicality, his athletic skills, his catching ability, and his speed for his size. So, so to go back to your original question, I think I agree with you. I think the original tight end, you know, like when we would talk about what we call like 21 personnel, which is two back, one tight end, which was really, you know, the traditional, you know, quote unquote, like pro I formation. Mm-hmm. You know, that tight end was like what we call an inline tight end, which, he was like the Mark Pavaro type, you know, who played for the Giants probably in the 80s. You know, he was on the line of scrimmage. He was an excellent blocker. But he was also a threat in the pass game. Don't get me wrong, but he was nothing like a Gronkowski, you know, where you could split him out, you know, in the slot. He could be your number two receiver. You could motion him across the formation, and you know, and you're asking a 6 foot, you know, 190 pound nickelback to cover him. You know, he's 6'5", you know, 260. So, you know, that's where I think the game has gone. And you see a lot of, you know, there's other tight ends, in the NFL and college that, you know, give teams just a, you know, really tough mismatch when it comes to that. So.
Well, that's kind of more than anything to me what has changed over the last even 5 years, but really kind of 10 years, is that there's a lot less value in guys in an offense who can only do one thing. You know, running backs who can only run have way less value. Tight ends who can only block or who can only catch have way less value. And really, even at the wide receiver position, guys who can only play outside or guys who can only play inside have way less value. Like, the typical yep. slot wide receiver, unless he plays for a team that it goes three wide most of the time, even those guys have less value now. So the types of athletes that are being preferred now are a lot different.
Yeah, absolutely. I think players who bring multiple skill sets, because really that's ultimately what the spread offense, you know, asks of an offense, is to be, you know, multiple within a spread formation. I mean, and again, you still have to block. You know, like I said this from day one, like if you're going to spread the formation and your perimeter receivers are not good blockers, you know, you're not going to have a great run game. And if you ask any wide receiver coach, you know, who coaches in the spread offense or, you know, a multiple spread, you know, offense, they're going to say, yeah, I mean, you know, the difference between Ezekiel Elliott running for an 8-yard gain and a 70-yard touchdown is usually the wide receivers in space who could block. But at the same time, the next play, you want them now to run the perfect inside fade, you know, for, you know, route for a touchdown. So it's those guys that can give you these multiple skill sets that are just becoming extremely valuable at every level of football.
Right, like, and that's something that the Rams wide receivers do really well, like Cooper Kupp and Robert Woods. I think McVay actually, when talking about signing Robert Woods, said one of the things that they really liked about him was how good of a run blocker he was, and that's kind of one of my ideas. This idea that I have kind of moving forward in college, and I mean, you can do this at any level of football, but having guys who can play basically both the running back and the wide receiver position and who can move around pre-snap, because I think that almost, and you as a coach should help me answer this, you know, how much more difficult would that make it, you know, as a defensive coordinator or as the middle linebacker calling that stuff out, how much more confusing would it be if there are players on the field who can play both running back and wide receiver and they can switch based on, you know, down and distance?
Oh, it's incredibly valuable. You can't express the value enough. I mean, and that's why on the defensive side of the ball, defenses are having to match these, you know, multi-skilled offensive players with multi-skilled defensive players. I mean, the buzzword over the last 3-4 years, you know, at all levels is the hybrid second level player on defense, you know, where, you know, he could drop down in the box. He could play the run on run downs, but he could also, you know, he could walk himself out as an overhang player, and he can cover man on a number two receiver. He can also blitz off the edge, you know, similar to how an outside linebacker would only do, you know, maybe 15 years ago. So, look, at the end of the day, it's a personnel game. It's mismatches, and that's what the best minds in this game still look at it. You know, look at tape with their opponent and say, how can we get the best mismatch? It all starts via formation, pre-snap motions, which have become so popular now. I mean, in the NFL, I mean the amount of jet speed and jet motions you see now from teams like the Rams. And the Bears, with some of these coaches that really embrace the, you know, kind of quote unquote college offense is just amazing, because they realize that pre-snap motion, it distorts a defense, it's all about, again, it all comes back to, you know, how do you get the best personnel mismatch? So if I have my guy on the left side of the formation, and I know if I jet them across to the right, whether they're following me or not based on coverage, you know, whether it's man or zone, their ultimate goal, the reason why they're doing that, is just to kind of create a mismatch with whoever, you know, eventually they want to get the football to. So it's becoming really, really a big part of the game.
So, like, the story of the 2018 NFL season is going to be what you were just talking about, the jet sweep play that is technically a pass but is really more of a handoff, where the whole defense gets going one way and the small wide receiver, you know, Tyreek Hill, Taylor Gabriel, Albert Wilson, they're coming back across the formation and getting that little shovel pass. That's like, that is a play that has, you know, old Pop Warner, like, single, what was the format, the single T? That's like basically that play, but in 2018.
Again, that's just one play. That's kind of really, you know, that's kind of been the flavor of the first kind of month and a half, I guess. I guess we're into the NFL. You know, that play when, I guess, week one, when Kansas City pulled that out and they, they scored on it not once but twice within the 5-yard line. You know, once to DeAnthony Thomas. And then once the Tyreek Hill, you know, the same exact play, and people were like, wow, what the hell was that? You know, like, you know. And then I think I've seen about eight other teams use it now, you know, since then. So, again, it's a copycat league. It always has been. But if you look back to last year, I know, you know, I talked about this in detail on, you know, on my website and my, my social media pages was, you look at the use of motion last year, like, like Sean McVay's first year, you know, with the Rams, he really, you know, and now he's just added layers and layers on it, you know. But at the end of the day, it's all about, you know, it's creating that horizontal stretch, because when you got a guy running 4.4 or 4.38, you know, when he's jetting across the formation, you know, like, first of all, he's got a head start, right? So it's just basic physics, right? When something's at when something's still as opposed to in motion, it's harder to catch up to. And then secondly, what it does is, because you have to, there's a natural expansion horizontally of the defense when there is that jet motion, because again, you hear this term all the time, we got to set the edge, because if they do hand it to that guy, you know, one of the worst things in football is not setting the edge. So letting a guy getting around the end, you know, and, if you don't do that, the only way to do that is really to, you know, to defend horizontally. And what happens is now, teams are now seeing these vertical voids that are created in the secondary as a result of this. And they're just sending, like, you know, really, you know, well-skilled, you know, receivers up these alleys, and it's creating huge opportunities. It's not only receivers, it's running backs. Like, I remember Todd Gurley last year catching a ball. You know, he runs what we call the rail route, which is, you know, it's like a combination wheel route and rail route, where the running back's in the backfield, and he comes around the edge of the offense, and he just heads just vertically right up the field.
That's the most undefeated route in football. That is easily my favorite play, the running back wheel route.
Yep. So, you know, some people call it the rail route, some call it the wheel. It really depends, you know, if it's to the boundary or to the field and where it is. But it's basically a seam route is what it is, you know. It's just finding a vertical seam, and it's such an advantageous advantage to the offense, because a lot of times you got these, you know, this athlete like Todd Gurley, it comes down to personnel. You know, the guy responsible for covering him is like a run plugger, you know, who's, again, those guys are getting better on defense. I'm not, you know, like, the defense is catching up. It just has to, right? It's evolution, because the defense at some point says, look, we got to start drafting, or we got to start recruiting, depending on what level of football you are, you know, a guy who can cover this play. Because if you don't, you're just going to get exploited by it every time it's ran. So, you know, defenses are getting better at it. They're finding better athletes on the second level. And, you know, but it's just fun to watch the schematic back and forth, you know, on both sides of the ball.
So changing lanes a little bit. One thing that, as, you know, an outsider, you know, I quit playing football pretty young, around 12, 13, and my friends kept playing, and I have friends who are football coaches and stuff, but a really fascinating topic to me is the coaching of quarterbacks, because so much of what quarterbacks do is it's split-second decision-making, it's intuition. So in terms of coaching quarterbacks, what is, you know, to you, the best philosophical way to coach quarterbacks, and how much of their decision making and, you know, their split second reactions, how much of that can be taught, and how much of that is just intuitive and something that these guys just have to have?
So I think, like any other position, whether it's corporate America or it's sports or it's anything, right? The person, right, the individual, the player, has to have a certain, you know, innate ability, you know, ability inside of them, you know. So, it all starts with that. I mean, it's, you know, some guys are just made for the position. It's a very demanding position. The ball's in your hand every snap, You know, it doesn't always end in your hand, obviously, but it starts with you. You know, you're the field general. You're calling the plays. You're changing the, you know, you're changing the coverages at the line. You're changing the plays. You know, you're calling out the cadence. So it takes a certain person, first of all, to be a quarterback. You know, it's just, that's a definite. And I'm not talking just physical ability, obviously, right? You got to be able to throw the football. You know, you got to have a certain, you know, stature to you. And I think it's great. You look at a guy like Drew Brees, right? He's like 5'10", you know, 195 pounds, and, you know, he just broke the passing yards record. So it's not necessarily that you have to be the prototypical 6'4", you know, 225, you know, with the rifle arm. It's just you have to have this certain, you know, what we call like the it factor. You know, you just have to have it. And it's tangible and intangibles, you know. So it's a combination of that.
So in terms of the, you know, I do agree with you that some of it definitely does have to be intuitive. You know, the guys just have to be able to lead an offense. They have to be able to make those decisions. But how do you begin to mold those raw tools into something that can really make an offense, you know, hum?
Well, it goes back to coaching. You have someone who has the athletic ability. They have the demeanor and all that. And then, you know, it comes down to coaching and teaching. And it's like anything else, right? So if, you want to become a great mathematician, right? There's probably five, you know, colleges out there that, you know, really teach it well. You know, that if you get a degree from there, you're going to advance to probably a very good career. So I think what happens is it's a funnel process that, you know, with social media, with internet, with everything, you know, like quarterbacks are seen now all over the place. So, it ultimately comes down to, as long as they have the resources, you know, and the parents backing and things like that, it's, you know, okay, so how do we get him to the best, you know, whether it's, private quarterback instructor, or how do we get them to the best, you know, program that, you know, maybe, you know, puts out the best quarterbacks every year. And now, again, what I love what's happening now over the last like 5-6 years is, you know, when you see guys like Baker Mayfield coming into the pros, and, you know, they have this different skill set, and people are like, wow, I just never thought he was going to make it, you know, because of his, you know, whether it was the system he came from, or his size, or maybe he got into a little bit of trouble or things like that. Like, I think that mold of like the perfect quarterback, and he should go into the perfect system. Like it used to be USC, or it used to be, University of Miami or something like that. Like that, that's kind of gone. So but at the end of the day, it still comes down to coaching. And it's an interesting thing. Like if you look at the best quarterbacks, you know, or a group of great quarterbacks in the NFL, like, I still think it all starts with the head coach, you know, of a program that you get with. I think that helps a quarterback tremendously. Like, I mean, just think of Tom Brady, right? I don't think it's a coincidence that Tom Brady and Bill Belichick have helped each other, you know, become, you know, two greats that'll go down in the history of the NFL. I mean, even though Belichick is more known as a defensive mind, I think he holds such a high standard for Brady and vice versa. You know, I think they push each other. And, you know, think of guys down the line. Like, you can go all the way back to Otto Graham with Paul Brown, you know, or Roger Staubach with Tom Landry, you know, Terry Bradshaw with Chuck Knoll. I think it starts with, you know, great head coaches hire great assistants who then, you know, are the ones that are coaching and teaching, you know, these quarterbacks on a daily basis in practice. And, you know, and there's so much, you know, there's so many details in that position. You know, there's film study, you know, there's, you know, especially today, because there's so much demand on the quarterback with what he has to, you know, what he has to orchestrate out on the field, you know, pre-snap. You know, like quarterbacks are being asked to do more and more now, you know, even at a younger and younger age. So, and that all has to come, you know, from their coaches. So it's really getting, aligned with a great coach, a great, quarterback, private instructor. And then, all the stuff we talked about previously about physical, mental, and intangibles, you hope that all kind of gets together and, you create a great quarterback.
Something in terms of coaching that I really liked was the Air Raid guys, Hal Mumme and Mike Leach. They picked up this drill where basically the whole offense, everyone on the offense, the backups, the starters, the third string, when they were at Iowa Wesleyan, they would basically just do 100-yard drives against the air for like an hour at practice. And I think that, to me, really makes sense in terms of how you want to coach specifically high school and college-age kids, is you just have kind of 10, 15 plays that you have them run, and they just run them for an hour, and all the kids run them. And in that way, they're learning the reps. They're learning what to look for, and it becomes intuitive. It becomes second nature, and it's not something they have to think about every time you call the play.
I agree with you. You know what? Repetition. There's a reason why a baseball player gets into a batting cage, and takes, just how many swings, right, at a ball. And you would say, God, why does that guy have to take, 500 swings, a day or whatever? It's because it's repetition. That's, it's just that constant muscle memory. And I agree with you. Quarterback play is the same way. And it's the same for the receivers, too. I mean, I've seen, we have some pretty elite, high school programs, in the area that I'm in. And, many years ago, there's a program, Don Bosco Prep, which is in Ramsey, New Jersey. It's produced, a lot of professional players and, dozens and dozens of, kids, at the Division I college level. And I was at one of their practices once in the middle of the summer, and I watched Leonte Carew, who's on the Miami Dolphins. He was a senior at the time at Don Bosco, or maybe a junior, I don't know. And, he went to Rutgers, had a great career, obviously made it to the NFL. And I watched him run maybe 50 times, 50 to 75 times the same route over and over, him and his quarterback. It was just a long cross-country route. And, and I said to myself, it's unbelievable. This is why the kid's an all-state player, And that's just one practice I was at, just out of the blue. I just kind of was invited by someone, I went and watched their practice. And
right.
So it gets back to your point. It's just constant repetition. But there has to be someone behind the scenes, pushing him. To do that, and again, part of that is his internal motivation, him and the quarterback, right? So, there has to be it's internal motivation, and then it's external motivation. So, that at the end of the day is the combination, to get a, quarterback to play at a high level.
So for, for pretty much the entire time this podcast has existed, I've talked, to analysts and to coaches and everyone about the offense, about how teams should pass the ball more and run the ball a little bit less. But you still do need to run the ball. You need the ability to keep the defense off balance. You need to be able to get, conversions on third and short, fourth and one. So philosophically, how does running the ball fit into spread concepts?
Oh, I think it's critical. I mean, I think one of the biggest misconceptions is that, spread teams can't run the football. They maybe quote unquote don't have the physicality, because they're in a spread offense or a spread, predominantly spread formation. I mean, I'll jump back to the college game. I think of the Rich Rodriguez West Virginia teams. He got to West Virginia, I think it was 2001, and I think from 2002 to 2008. And they had some pretty good runs there. I mean, winning the Big East, almost getting to, Pat White and Steve Slayton and, some really big numbers. I think they were top five in the country in rushing the football, probably, the majority of those years he was there, because, they realized that, spreading a defense via formation pre-snap and then running the football is sometimes even more effective than it is in the pass game, because once you're running back or dual threat quarterback, you know, gets to the second level, there's a lot of space for the next guy who's, you know, covering a receiver down the field or being blocked by a receiver. Again, that 53 and a third yards is a lot of, you know, it's a lot of grass to cover. He realized early that the spread option game, you know, or the power spread was, you know, was very valuable. And I think if you look at Lincoln Riley, who, I heard something the other day that I think over 30 NFL coaches went to go visit him this off season. You know, just
I mean, he's the next big thing. Lincoln Riley is that man is going to change the game.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And I mean, when you get 30 NFL teams coming to your, he said I think the most previous to this year was about five teams he had, I guess. Maybe in the year prior, but I mean, you're talking just a trend. You know, people are just dying for his for his knowledge, and guys like Andy Reid have been taking advantage of it now for years. And but if you look at Oklahoma last year, they averaged 5.6 yards a rush on offense. I mean, so even though Lincoln Riley, he came from he came from Texas Tech, I know he was at East Carolina for a while. I think that's where he learned the value of running the football, not only just throwing it. But, I think I looked at, Alabama's average. Alabama ran the ball 5.7 yards a carry. So, Oklahoma's right there. And, if you told that to people, they'd be like, wow, I didn't think they were that good of a running team, So, he realizes the value of running the football, and I think it just comes down to, it's a numbers game. Everything that's going on in football now is reading how many guys are in the tackle box, and can we run the football? Can we run the football? Because I still love running the football. I mean, when I'm an offensive coach, and the years that I've been an offensive coach, I got no problem, handing the ball off or, using a dual threat quarterback. That's just another deadly weapon. So, I think it's just a misconception that, spread offense and rushing the football can't be, tied in with each other.
Definitely. And actually, this was not on our agenda, but something I did want to ask you is, so we talk about this from the offensive side of the conversation, but from a defensive coordinator perspective, what are one or two of the biggest weapons that you can use to combat the spread and the heavy attack passing game?
Yeah, well, it all starts at the line of scrimmage. I think if you look at the Rams, with Aaron Donald and Sue and I think Sean McVay realizes that the best way to neutralize any offensive system is to control the line of scrimmage. And what I mean by control, you hear that word a lot. Okay, well, they controlled the line of scrimmage. Well, I think when you start displacing the line of scrimmage, meaning pushing it into the backfield, it doesn't matter what you're running. It doesn't matter if you're running the old Packer sweep with Vince Lombardi, or you're running, an Andy Reid, explosive Kansas City offense of the current era. If you're getting manhandled up front, that's why defensive tackles and defensive ends are at such a premium in college football. I know at the high school level, when college coaches come around, there's a reason why Nick Saban gets the best defensive lineman every year at Alabama. And there's a reason why he's the most successful coach, because he's getting the best defensive linemen every year. The Jonathan Allens, the Darry, who was it, Marcellus Darry. Just if you look at his tenure, and he's got two guys on the Redskins. I was watching the other night. Two Alabama guys on their D front, and they were just dominant players in college. So I think it all starts at the line of scrimmage. You got to dominate the line of scrimmage to neutralize a spread offense or really any offense. And then secondly, I talked about earlier was you got to have more hybrid type players, But at the same time, they still got to be able to be run pluggers, like run stoppers. So it's a very unique skill set that, you know, that's being required now on defense, because teams are smart. They're realizing that. And again, you know, this is why Lincoln Riley's averaging 5.6 yards a carry, because he's spreading you out via formation. He realizes that, you know, one of your overhang players now is what we call a fold player, maybe into the B gap. And that player, you know, like if he brings one of his, you know, 6'4", 300-pound D tackles through on a counter, that guy's about 6'2", 215. Now, he's very fast. He can cover in space. But he's going to have a hard time taking on that block. So, you know, the next generation is really finding guys that are, you know, just, you know, still very and the other thing, tackling, unfortunately, is becoming a lost art in football.
And yeah, I think, you know, NFL teams are really bad at it. There are some teams that just can't wrap anyone up to save their life.
Yeah, I agree. And it's here's the thing. Tackling is a skill, all right? And a skill has to be practiced. We talked about, you know, the hitter in the batting cage, or we talked about the quarterback play. You know, you talked about repetition. If you're not tackling during the week, you're just not going to be very good at it on Sunday. There's no getting around that. And I understand it's all about safety. I'm 100% for safety of the players. But, you know, like, it's a different game. When I started coaching 25 years ago, the first 15 years of my coaching, career, you know, we hit pretty hard, like twice a week during the week. And then we hit like somewhat hard a third day. You know, now, there's weeks that, you know, I see it, you know, with my current team and, you know, even over the last couple years, you know, we just don't tackle that much, you know, for numerous different reasons. It's a culture that's kind of creating this really horrible tackling. But what that's doing is creating a lot of explosive offense, because if you can't bring these guys to the ground, they're just going to run for touchdowns. So, you know, I think those are key. And then you got to have cover guys. Overall, you got to have a great defense to stop a great offense. And that's what I think, you know, guys like Nick Saban's figured out. He's able to recruit the best of the best on the defensive side of the ball. And that's why he gets so many guys drafted into the pros. I mean, you know, you got to have great cover guys on the perimeter too. So basically what I just explained in 10 minutes is you just have to have great players that are very well coached and well taught on defense, I guess.
Yeah, you just got to have the best players. That's all you need to do to win, is just have players who are better than everyone else.
And you got to coach the heck out of them. You know, you got to teach. You got to coach. I mean, it's one thing to have great players, but schematically a team could still, you know, exploit you. Even if you via scheme, because there's so many great minds out there. You know, kids still have to be coached. They got to be taught, you know.
So before I let you go, when you get a chance to watch football on Sundays, what is the number one thing that drives you crazy in terms of decision making that coaches do? You know, it could be the lack of understanding of a concept, or doing, you know, calling a certain play in a situation that you just would never do. What's the number one decision making process that coaches do that drives you crazy?
I got to be honest with you, because I've been in a coach's position, you know, again, at a much lower level. I watch a game and I just kind of look at the overall picture. Now, again, is there some plays where I say, oh man, you know, why did they call that? Yeah. But the thing is, I don't go into watching a game saying, oh man, I can't wait to see like how bad this call is going to be, this and that. I'm looking more towards the great schemes that are coming out now, especially, you know, on Sunday, because the NFL used to be painful to watch, you know. I mean, you know, it wasn't too long ago, like 4 or 5 years ago, and it started to change. But I'll tell you this, and again, it goes back to, you know, I always say players over plays. I think if you watch football, what offensive coaches are trying to do is, you know, they're looking for the numbers advantages on the field. So whether it's in the box, whether it's on the perimeter. And I think what's amazing is how, you know, sometimes you'll see a run play and you'll see a run play into an eight-man box, and you'll say, oh, man, you know, maybe that wasn't a great call because there's only six guys blocking eight. And, you know, I'm not a great math student. You know, I wouldn't be a football coach if I was good at math, but I know, like, you know, like you're short two hats, right? So
sure.
There's a great chance that play isn't going to do well. But at the same time, and again, it goes back to players over plays, sometimes I'll see guys run into an eight-man box, and you'll see someone, you know, run over the Mike linebacker, they'll juke out the free safety, and he goes 60 yards for a touchdown. So the play worked because the player made it work, you know. Or, you know, another example, like you'll see a bubble screen out to the perimeter, and there's two guys out there over three. So the defense has three to the field over two on an offense. And you say, man, why'd they throw that ball there? I mean, there's one guy who can come right up and make the play, no one there to block him. But at the same time, you'll see the same play, and, you know, Tyreek Hill jukes out that guy, and he goes 60 yards for a touchdown. So, you know, like the person with the normal eye doesn't see the, you know, I'm always looking for numbers and mismatches and angles and things like that. So it's I don't get aggravated because I realize at the end of the day, you know, as long as team, you know, if teams are well coached, like coaches are never going to make the perfect call on every play. You know, if you get 65 offensive plays in a game, you know, you just have to go through it methodically and say, based on the situation, I think this play is going to work, and then you go with it because I've been in that situation. So I don't really, you know, unless it's really just something stupid like, you know, you bring the punt team out and you try a fake and it's 4th and 12, you know, and you had no chance, or, you know, then I'm like, oh, man, you know, that didn't make sense. Why not just punt the ball away? You know, I look at the kind of big picture kind of goof ups, you know, because unfortunately I've made some of them too, but, you know, like I don't know, maybe it makes me feel good that some other people are doing it also, you know, so. You know, I mean, that's my thought on that. So
there we go. All right, Coach, thank you so much for coming on and talking to me, chatting with me about the game we all love. Why don't you tell the folks a little bit about spreadoffense.com?
Sure. So I started the website in 2007, spreadoffense.com. And, you know, we're 11 years into it. It's a, you know, it's a good site for information, whether you're a coach, you're a player, or even just a fan of the game. And, you know, more importantly, you know, I've really, you know, we've picked up our social media presence. So, you know, look us up on Twitter, you know, handle @SpreadOffense. We're also on Facebook and LinkedIn. And, you know, we're always putting good info out. You know, I'm analyzing plays and, we try to make it, you know, both educational and, you know, entertaining for the coaches, players, and fans that are, you know, out there looking at our stuff. So
fantastic. That's @CoachCollier on Twitter, everyone, and you can follow his work at Spread Offense. Thank you again to Coach Collier for joining us here on the TakeCast. As always, remember that leaving a rating and review on iTunes is very helpful. And also, we have launched a Patreon with special exclusive episodes that you can only get if you are a patron of the podcast. All you have to do is go to patreon.com/takecast. You can find the link to that in the description of this episode. And as always, thank you for listening.